The Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement will come to order. The first item on the agenda tonight is approval of the minutes of March 5th. Senator Sinjam moves approval of the minutes as printed. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
The motion is adopted. Second item on the agenda tonight is the report of the Fire State Aid Work Group that they worked on over the interim. Ms. Morse? Mr. McCoy, Mr. Hempstead, Ms. Finn. Welcome to the commission.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the commission. My name is Shayna Morse. Last time you saw me, it was Shayna Jones. I'm the communication director at PARA. And then with me tonight are Fire State Aid Work Group members. I'll let them introduce themselves, but they represent their respective groups from fire chiefs to firefighters and municipalities. So our plan for this evening, if we may proceed, is to just provide a brief overview of the work that the Fire State Aid Working Group did over the interim and our recommendations to the commission. And then, like I said, we'll have some testimony from the people to my left and right. And I'm working off of this PowerPoint. So the 2018 Omnibus Retirement Bill established a working group to be convened by PARA in Minnesota Laws 2018, Chapter 11, Article 14, Section 27. The purpose was to study the allocation of fire state aid and make recommendations to the LCPR. Specifically, we were tasked with looking at the current requirement that all fire state aid provided to municipalities with volunteer firefighters be used to fund service pensions as governed under 353G, which is the PARA statewide plan, or 424A, which governs volunteer relief firefighter associations. Secondly, we're also charged with looking at modifying that requirement to allow municipalities to allocate a portion of the aid to pay employer contributions to the PARA police and fire plan. So the law also outlined some work group requirements that we had to consider when we were making our recommendations. Those are listed on page 3 and include the history and purpose of fire state aid, the history, purpose, and utilization of Minnesota Statutes 2012, Section 353A.10, which allowed certain municipalities to allocate a portion of fire state aid to pay their PARA police and fire contributions. We were required to look at or consider the impact on current volunteer firefighters, recruitment and retention, and municipalities, and a presentation by the City of Austin and the City of Austin Relief Association. The statute set forth the work group members and included individuals from the League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association, Minnesota State Fire Departments Association, and then representatives from the Office of the State Auditor and Department of Revenue. The specific members are listed on page 4 of the PowerPoint. I have 3 of those members with me here today. Ms. Hennessy Allen and Auditor Blaha are here from the Department or from the Office of the State Auditor to answer questions, and then also representatives are here from the Department of Revenue on that part as well. Mr. Mike Scott from the City of Eagan was elected as chair. Unfortunately, he's with his city council this evening and actually, I guess, dealing with this very issue with them. So timely in that way. So the report issued by the work group, which can be found in its entirety on the LCPR's website, provides a very detailed history of the changes to the fire state aid program over the years. For our purposes tonight, I'm going to highlight just a very few key dates. So I'm working off page 5 now. The fire state aid program was first established in 1885, that is, with the primary purpose of providing benefits for firefighters injured in the line of duty. Secondarily, the program was to support fire departments with maintenance and equipment needs. So we are talking about something going back quite some time. When this was established, a firefighter, whether the firefighter was a volunteer, that is, or a full-time firefighter, was not a factor in the municipality's eligibility for fire state aid or in how the state aid was calculated. At the time of the program's creation, relief associations were the only vehicle for firefighter retirement benefits, and so there was no need to address contributions to the Parapolice and Fire Plan. In 1943, the authority to use fire state aid for maintaining and equipping the fire department was repealed. 2 years later, it was clarified that the fire state aid could be used to maintain and equip the fire department. Then in 1959, the Parapolice and Fire Plan was finally established. And at that time, the provisions governing fire state aid were not amended to specifically acknowledge the use of fire state aid in funding contributions to that plan. During the 1970s and 1980s, many of these relief associations covering full-time firefighters ended up closing to new members, and any new entrants or new firefighters that were full-time came into the Parapolice and Fire Plan. Again, during that time, nothing was amended, or fire state aid provisions were not addressed to reflect potentially those changing needs. Over the 1980s and 90s, these now closed volunteer relief associations, or excuse me, full-time firefighter relief associations, began merging in with PARA. And so it was at that time that there were laws put in place that really allowed for the allocation of fire state aid. The law that first allowed for that fire state aid was repealed in 2013. And so that's really why we're here today. Moving on to page 6. The way that fire state aid works today, it's funded by a surcharge paid by homeowners insurance companies on homeowners insurance premiums. Once that money is collected, the sequence of events is as follows as far as how it's paid out. If there is a PARA statewide volunteer firefighter plan, PARA receives the money directly and it's deposited into those individual accounts. If there's a relief association for volunteers instead of a PARA statewide plan, the municipality receives the money but must transfer the entire amount to that volunteer firefighter relief association, regardless of the VRFA's funding requirements. If there is no PARA statewide plan or no volunteer relief association, the municipality may use the funding to pay PARA P&F contributions on behalf of full-time firefighters that contribute to that plan. And then finally, if none of those exist, there's no volunteer retirement plan or there's no full-time PARA police and fire participants, the municipality may use the funds for membership fees in firefighter organizations and or to maintain and equip the fire department. The current allocation and use requirements have become a topic of discussion for a couple of reasons. First, as I previously mentioned, the provision that allowed this to be allocated to be used by both the towards the volunteer firefighter retirement contributions and the PARA police and fire contributions was repealed in 2013. Secondly, several fire departments, specifically those in the metro area, where individuals may live in a suburb or an exurb but work in the metro area, they have trouble finding volunteers, and so they're having to do some staffing shuffling needs to figure out how to properly perform their public safety duties. And so some of those departments find themselves needing to hire these full-time firefighters in lieu of volunteers and may experience an increase in their pension costs, while they also may experience a decrease in the number of volunteers that they have on staff. And so when that happens, the financial result is that a fewer number of volunteers are receiving the entire amount of fire state aid. So knowing all of that, some municipalities express the desire to use fire state aid to support their department's changing needs by allowing it to be allocated to pay for employer contributions in the police and fire plan. After learning about all of this history and fire state aid and allocation, hearing from firefighters, hearing from municipalities, the work group made 4 recommendations on proceeding to reflect how they saw compromise going forward to work best for all parties, which is on page 8. So I'll walk through the 4 recommendations of the work group. So first, general legislation is preferred. The statutes are viewed as insufficient currently to address the change in desires and needs of fire departments. At the same time, the work group recognizes that case-by-case special legislation is likely to be an ongoing long-term need that would be time-consuming, and again, thus general legislation is preferred. The work group also recommends that the allocation of fire state aid for para, police, and fire contributions should be permissive. The group recommends allowing it to be allocated by municipalities that have both volunteer and full-time firefighter pension costs to the respective plans. However, the group also recognizes that one size would not fit all, and so thus allocation should be permissive and not mandatory. Because local government autonomy is desired. So, again, allowing allocation in a permissive manner supports local autonomy. In Minnesota, local governments are responsible for public safety needs, and there is a desire that the work group expressed to have the state support those local governments in trying to figure out how to do that best. And then finally, agreement is key to allowing these allocations to occur. The municipality and the Relief Association Board should agree to any allocation that occurs. In the case of the Paris statewide plan, since the Relief Association Board is no longer required to exist, the majority of active firefighters should also agree. And this ensures that municipalities have flexibility and that volunteers are actively involved in the decision-making process. And so a final note on the work group. The work group acknowledges that in some cases, agreement may not be able to be reached. The LCPR may need to revisit the allocation requirements in the future if there's evidence of a lack of willingness to negotiate for the greater good on either party's end. And so with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to turn it over to our testifiers. And we'll start with Jim McCoy, representing the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association.
Mr. McCoy.
Hello, Jim McCoy, Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. Our concern with the State Chiefs Association is staffing. The fire service is changing, and we currently need to hire more full-time people to replace volunteers that are no longer willing to step up and serve our communities. With increased need for full-time personnel, our PERA, police and fire pension contributions are going to increase, and we could use that money that we would receive from the state aid to offset those costs. And we do not need to create a budget shortfall, which could affect services later on if we don't have the funds to help offset these police and fire PERA contributions. We, as the State Chiefs Association, like the permissive legislation, and it gives us local control of that money. While doing this, we do not want to harm our volunteers, and being able to come to an agreement with our volunteers is our goal. So we approve of the legislation and would like to move forward with it. Thank you.
Ms. Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank the Commission for creating this working group and for hearing the report tonight. I'm here to support the recommendations of the report and to thank my co-members for their thoughtful work. And I want to also note the strong leadership of the PERA staff in facilitating a process that captured some really good work and did reflect the consensus of the group. The report from the perspective of the League of Minnesota Cities, and as you just heard from Chief McCoy, helps address the emerging issue of a growing number of combination fire departments. I want to also note that the recommendations in this report complement the recommendations that you will hear later when you get the report from the Fire Relief Association Conversions and Dissolutions Working Group. The two really need to move together in order to resolve some of the issues that you faced in the previous biennium. And with that, I'll stop for any questions. Thank you.
Mr. Hempstead.
Madam Chair, Senators, Representatives Bruce Hempstead, Bemidji Fire Department, representing the Minnesota State Fire Department Association. I've had the pleasure of being able to work on all three work groups that you're going to hear from this evening. Interestingly, On two of the three, I was the only Greater Minnesota paid on-call firefighter to serve. On the other, there was one additional paid on-call firefighter that was able to serve. The work group had a very diverse membership, all with, at times, differing interests in the process. And so what's amazing about all of this, and we worked at it long and hard, we started early, as a matter of fact. We started back in 2017 in anticipation that the omnibus bills would finally become law and we would have to gather ourselves together. So we had a background and knowledge of each other coming into the official work group environment. Again, each of us brought a variety of different interests to the process, but we concluded that there needs to be consensus if there's any hope for anything positive and constructive to happen. And that's exactly what did happen during the give and take of the work group process. We have 100% consensus on these four recommendations. And I think two of them are paramount. Bemidji Fire Department is one of the 78 combination fire departments in Minnesota that could potentially be impacted by this. But one of the recommendations being permissive, which then in essence says we don't have to do anything, either the municipality or the relief association. And the second element, and why that's important, it stays with the local unit of government and the local relief association. We believe very, very strongly as a work group and individually that local government autonomy is where we need to be. There are some 760 different fire departments with relief associations in the state, and no one of those departments or municipalities is the same as the other. So to try to fit something cookie cutter into this process would be extremely, if not totally, impossible to do. With that, I'll quit and sit for questions. Thank you.
Okay. The members of the commission have any questions of the four people that have spoken? Yes, not. Members, in your packets is a draft, a rough draft of the four recommendations that were spoken of in the report. And I think we will consider that as a first try. And if you have any questions today about this, after a very quick perusal, you may ask them. Otherwise, Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a chance to quickly peruse it, and I'm curious, it addresses the agreement, but what happens if there's not an agreement? Is that in here? I'm trying to find that.
Ms. Morris.
Madam Chair, Representative Vogel. So if there's not an agreement reached, the status quo would prevail. And for right now, the group felt like we couldn't possibly seek to address all of those scenarios that would exist. And so if you noted in the report, too, there is a little final note that says that may be something that comes before the commission in the future if there's evidence that agreement can't be reached and a good faith effort's not put into negotiating.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was the question.
Ms. Morris.
I didn't see how it was resolved.
Will this change as some of the players change? The people that aren't used to the status quo?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I could predict the future. I think that what will be just personally key to seeing how this goes, there'll be a couple that want to dabble right away, and so they'll go to work and negotiate and try to follow the provisions that are set forth in the draft, and if we have to amend them. And I think then we just have to continue to monitor and see how that works to make sure that we've dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. But in theory, the language shouldn't change going forward. The agreements on the local level may be what get renegotiated on an ongoing basis.
All right. Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Morse or whoever on the committee. So is there any overlap between these recommendations and what might be coming out of the other two work groups that are on the agenda for tonight? Is that Mr. Hempstead?
Mr. McCoy.
Mr. Hempstead, right.
I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think there's a limited amount of overlap, but they clearly are separate issues. The State Auditor's Work Group has been in that business for some 10 years now, so most of what we recommend there is our technical sorts of changes. There's only one new element that I'm truly aware of that would be different than what it is today, and it doesn't affect either of the two temporary work groups that we have. But as Ms. Finn had said, there is some overlap, and there was some overlapping discussions as the two work groups worked through, because there are crossover members that worked on both of those groups.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, the reason I ask this is I'm not sure what the chairwoman's plan is. I mean, if the plan was to start building the omnibus pension bill and adopt this, I just wanted to make sure that if we did this now, there wasn't going to be some conflict with some of the other two working groups, or should we wait till the end of the meeting to see for sure that doesn't happen, or do we need comments from the other working groups? So I just wasn't sure what your intention is with this draft.
Well, I want to hold the draft over for further consideration and inclusion at some point.
Madam Chair, but not tonight?
No.
Okay.
And I think I will have the next report will have the same. All right, is there any further discussion? Thank you so much, and thank you for your hard work, and thank you for contributing your time and efforts, and especially for coming down from Austin and Bemidji to the, I expect all the meetings were at the auditor's office, right? Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Because this highway only goes one way for
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I will keep these held over for possible reconsideration at a later time. Item 3 on the agenda is House File 438. Representative Poppy and Senate File 570, Senator Sparks, who is making an encore appearance from previous appearances for the same issue. Representative Poppy, Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I took the low chair, and I believe that Mr. Dankert, who stands, 2 feet taller than me ordinarily, took the high chair, so we'll adjust here. We have House File 483, Senate File 570 before you, and this extends special legislation providing for alternative allocation of fire state aid for the City of Austin. So as you just heard from people that were testifying, Austin was really probably the reason behind some of this to come before you, because it was the City of Austin that discovered when they were operating per usual, and then there was a change in law, but they were not familiarized with that until a couple of years into it. That's what caused the issue, the problem before you. So I appreciate that since then, the working group or groups have gotten together and are making some recommendations to the commission, because it is very unfortunate that the city has for a number of years now been going through this. And what we've tried to do, that's why we have been before this pension commission a couple of times, is to correct that for the city of Austin and be able to move forward. So we do have, Senator Sparks may have some comments he'd like to make, and then we have a testifier here as well.
All right. Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the commission. And I would just concur with what Representative Poppy has stated here this evening. We thought in last year's pension bill we were able to correct this problem. It was brought to our attention, but we still have a little cleanup work we need to do. We certainly appreciate you taking the opportunity to hear this bill tonight, and also want to thank the pension staff for working closely with us. In fact, at a certain point, we do have an amendment that we need to add at some point, Madam Chair, and then we'll turn over to Mr. Danker to kind of explain this, what hopefully will be the last piece of this. And again, thank you to the working group for their explanation. I think that really helped lay out why we're at this point, and hopefully it doesn't have to happen to other departments going forward.
Director Dankert.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Commission. I'm Tom Dankert, Director of Administrative Services for the City of Austin. I've been in that position since 1998. As some of you may recall, in last year's session, we were granted some relief from the 2013 through 2018 state fire aid contributions, whereby we are allowed to allocate a portion to the paid-on-call staff and keep the remaining to offset costs related to our full-time staff and PERA. That authorization was set to expire in July of 2019, and that date was picked based on the thought process that this working group that was created as part of the legislation would also have something passed that would allow us then in 2020 and beyond to continue to split the fire state aid if that's the agreement that was come to. Lo and behold, through the working group process, it appeared just based on logistics that that couldn't come into effect until the 2020 session. So here we are with the 2019 state fire aid set to come to us in October, and short of any changes in the proposed legislation, we would have to go back and give the entire amount to the paid-on-call relief association instead of splitting it like we currently do. So that was a request that we've brought forward that would then, again, allow us to do what we've done in the past and what was granted to us last session for one more year.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Burkett, would you like to clarify and summarize the bill before us and the amendment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. The bill simply extends the period for which it's effective to 2020. The amendment does three things. It extends the relief for liabilities to the year 2019. It clarifies that the relief is permanent. And then it adds some new effective language that's needed under the Constitution for special legislation that applies to an individual city.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, just to put the bill in the right order, I'd like to move the 1A amendment.
Okay. Senator Pappas moves adoption of Amendment 1A, 4831A. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. House File 483, as amended, is for us to be before us for further consideration and questions. And the City of Austin approves of this bill and amendment.
That's correct.
And the firefighters are happy.
Madam Chair, that's correct also.
And is there any opposition to House File 483 as amended? Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, once again, if it's your desire to start building the omnibus bill, I could make a motion that this be incorporated into the omnibus bill.
Please,
if we're ready.
Do that.
Okay, then I would move that House File 483, Senate File 570, as amended, be incorporated into the omnibus pension bill of 2019.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Poppe and Senator Sparks, I'm no stranger to this topic, as both of you know. We've been working on it for quite a while. I know that there were some other unresolved issues as we looked at it, given the fact that you had been operating in the city of Austin under what you thought was a good faith part of the state statute, and there were certain fines that were levied. Have you been able to get resolution on that or still seeking legislative help and support on that as well? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but it's an important and critical issue for the city of Austin, just like getting this issue resolved is as well.
Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Driscoll. Actually, I do have the other bill, the companion bill, going before the Property Tax Division tomorrow evening. So hopefully we will have that resolved or move that through the tax committees and be able to resolve that there. And I think, Senator Sparks is hoping for the same outcome, but that is what we're looking at.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else that wishes to comment on 483 as amended? If not, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. For inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members. Commission members.
Fourth item on the agenda is the State Auditor's Working Group Report. Welcome, Auditor Blaha and Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Thank you.
And
of course,
Mr.
MVP.
McCoy.
Mr. McCoy. Thank you, Chair Murphy, members of the Commission.
McCoy is from Austin. Hempstead from Bemidji. Excuse me.
Again, I'm very excited to be here. Again, I'm Julie Blaha, your state auditor. As someone who's been a longtime fan of this Commission, you may not realize I've listened to most of the proceedings, and this is just very exciting. I know you get that all the time with a commission like this, fans coming in, but I'm having a fangirl moment. I'm really enjoying this. So very happy to be here kicking off our presentation from the Volunteer Fire Relief Association Working Group. We'll be walking through the PowerPoint that you have included in your packet here. So just a bit of history to start. This group, of course, was created in 2004 under the Auditor Anderson administration and was brought together so that instead of getting numerous individual fire bills each session, they could come together, giving you a package that's quicker to work with, and ultimately to make sure that Fire Relief Association trustees are successful. That's our key. The meetings are convened and chaired by the state auditor. They meet in our office. We have representatives from around the state, representatives from both defined benefit and defined contribution plans, to municipal representatives, and, of course, LCPR staff that also attend and are a great resource to us. You'll see next that you have a list of the members that are from all around the state. And so the way the group has worked historically is that proposals are only forwarded to you for consideration if they receive unanimous consent from the working group. The meetings are open to the public. The documents are on our website. And members of the public do regularly attend and are, again, another great resource to us. Basically, the goals of our proposal are to improve recruitment and retention of firefighters, volunteer firefighters in particular, which we all agree is desperately important right now. We want to clarify statutes with this, and we also wanted to protect local control wherever we could. So letting things be as permissive as possible so that people can customize things for their communities. And now that we're on to the technical pieces, I have the opportunity to turn it over to our director, Rose.
Madam Chair, my name is Rose Hennessy Allen. I'm the pension director at the Office of the State Auditor. And I'll just briefly walk through the sections of the bill. Section 1 clarifies audit requirements for the Fire Relief Associations, and it clarifies that The audits must be conducted in compliance with generally accepted governmental auditing standards and include a legal compliance audit. These audits are performed by private CPAs. Our office is, does not perform the audits, so it's the private CPA firms that are doing them. And a legal compliance audit means that the private CPA follows the legal compliance audit guide, which is a checklist of the different requirements in statute that the relief association or government entity has to follow. Right now, only about 40% of relief associations are required to be audited. The audit threshold is $500,000. So about 60% don't have an annual audit, and instead they have agreed-upon procedures engagement. Section 2 changes the threshold at which additional investment reporting is required. Right now, the threshold is $25 million. That threshold has been increased a few times over the years and needs to be increased again to make sure that relief associations maintain their current reporting with our office. The only entities that are above that threshold right now are Bloomington Fire Department, Relief Association, St. Paul Teachers, and the SBI. Sections 3 and 5 deal with breaks or benefit levels for firefighters with a break in service. And right now, there's no definition of break in service in statute, so we're adding one in, and then also making a change so that if a firefighter has a break in service at the end of their firefighting career, the benefit level in effect when they began the break is the benefit level used to calculate their service pension. And this avoids situations where firefighters are getting benefit increases for periods when they weren't active. Section 4 is a return to service provision, and we're making technical changes there to clean up the language, and then also making a change so that if a firefighter is paid out a service pension and then wants to resume firefighting with the fire department, that the relief association could set a lower vesting requirement for that firefighter. And so the thought with that is to try to keep firefighters in the fire service. So if a firefighter gets paid out but still wants to serve for a few more years, that they could come back and put that service in and be compensated for that. Next, we get into vesting requirements. And so Section 6 are vesting requirements for the defined contribution plans. And these plans have been allowed to provide full vesting after 10 years of active service, and they've been allowed to do that since 2004. And one of the, I think the big change in this bill is extending that authority to the defined benefit plans too. And so that change is made in Section 8. And this is optional, so it's up to each relief association to decide if they want to have the lower vesting requirements. We're also rewriting the vesting provisions to make them easier to read and to clarify that you can't require more than 20 years to receive a fully vested service pension. So right now, for the defined contribution plans, only about 21% of them offer full vesting after 10 years. So even though that option's available, not all of them are choosing to do that. Section 7 and 9 relate to deferred interest, and these are technical changes to correct references to interest being paid during a member's period of deferral, and we're correcting that to read that the interest is credited during their period of deferral, and it's not paid out until the service pension is distributed. And then the last section is supplemental benefits. So supplemental benefits are an extra benefit that's paid out with the service pension distribution, and they are intended to help offset taxes that the firefighter has to pay. And so for regular service pensions, the supplemental benefit is 10% up to $1,000, and for survivor benefits, the supplemental is 20% up to $2,000. But a supplemental benefit can only be paid out for survivors if the benefit's going to a surviving spouse or surviving children. So if it's going to a designated beneficiary or to an estate, they currently are not eligible to get that extra benefit. And so this bill would extend eligibility to designated beneficiaries and to estates.
And Ms. Allen, is that in all circumstances then?
Madam Chair and Commission members, yes, that would be in all situations. So if there's a survivor benefit that's paid out and it's paid to a designated beneficiary or to an estate, the relief association would have authority to pay out a supplemental benefit.
And that wraps up our technical portions. I don't know if you would like to, if you'd like to add a comment about the process.
Mr. Hempstead.
Madam Chair, Commission members, thank you again. I've had the opportunity to work with the Office of the State Auditor's work group for, this would be my sixth year now. Again, as I mentioned earlier with one of our work groups, it's a very diverse group. Each of those members of that work group coming with different interests. And again, as was pointed out early on, nothing leaves the Office of the State Auditor work group and comes to your commission unless there's 100% consensus. If there is a disagreement, we give that disagreement one additional chance, one additional meeting, if you will, to meet with the work group. And if there's still no 100% consensus, it stays with the work group, doesn't come over here. And it's been a marvelous process. It's worked very, very well. Since 2004, the majority of the work of the work group becomes the technical work, much of which you heard again this evening. One piece that I would like to address is the potential change in vesting for the defined benefits plans. Currently, the statute is a 5-year minimum and a 20-year maximum. The language, again, is permissive, and it brings back the local autonomy, and it allows fire departments perhaps the opportunity to improve the recruitment and retention pieces that all of the departments across Minnesota, and for that matter, across the nation, are suffering right now. Our younger people are more diverse these days. They're more transient these days. They have young families that get them involved in a myriad of different sorts of things. So recruitment right off the bat is difficult. And again, with mobility, retention is also a difficult task. So by reducing the amount of years that you provide service to your community and yet become eligible to become 100% vested, I think is something that a lot of fire departments, relief associations would be interested in doing. It's not required. Today, defined benefit plans, I think the maximum is almost across the board at 20 years. 20 years is a long time for a young person, a young family to serve their community. And if they join us at a young age, keep in mind that they don't have access to any of their money until age 50. So it's a burden a lot of times, and I think it would bring a lot of comfort and generate some additional interest on the part of the younger community to join their fire department if they know that their service is valued and that there's a lesser time period where they can lock in some future benefits. With that, I thank you.
Mr. Hempstead, how does a local fire department learn how to market and to invite people to come and join?
Madam Chair, thank you. That's an interesting question. Our fire department on an annual basis has openings. Some years we are not as fortunate as others to get an adequate pool of interested candidates. They need to go through a series of interviews, physical agility tests, and written tests, which screens out a lot of potential folks. So it's a challenge, and it's not unique to a single department. It's, again, I honestly believe it's nationwide. Those years that we're not able to get a large enough pool, we simply have to operate with fewer firefighters. And that then becomes a challenge. Even though we are, in our particular instance, a combination department, so we have 24/7 coverage out of our headquarters station. We have three other stations that are paid-on-call firefighters staff. And when you don't have those folks available, and we're a very, very large, fire department, we cover 522 square miles. 14 townships and 3 cities. So it's a very unique situation, and I think the tools that we have, the tools that are being proposed for defined benefit plans, which are by far the majority of plans in Minnesota, might help that overall recruitment and retention issue that we all face.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there anyone, Representative O'Driscoll?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hennessy, I want to go back and make sure that I understood something, but before I do that, I want to underscore what Mr. Hampstead said to the Chair's question. I think if Bemidji had the secret, they would have no problem filling their department and market that to just about every department across the state, and perhaps, as you suggest, Mr. Hampstead, across the country as well.
Thank you.
I think that any provisions that we put forward on here needs to have a tiered vesting schedule so that you can bring people in, have a shorter commitment, and still be able to bring folks in, because it's very expensive on the upswing to be able to bring in to equip them in the proper size fitting equipment and the apparatus that they need, the training costs that are associated with that, the department integration costs that are associated with that, time and or dollars that are on that. So it's a huge, huge commitment and a huge obligation. And if somebody quits within a year or two, that is typically money you don't get back, because some of that apparatus and equipment is customized to the firefighter and to their physical stature and attributes. Ms. Hennessy, Allen, the point that I want to go back and make sure that I understood from you was that in a situation where you may have what I'll call an encore career back in fire service. So you might have retired after 20 years, it might be 43, it might be 45, and your community could still, you may still want to be a part of that, and your community may still benefit from your participation in that. Or you might not be going out and, as I always like to say, lugging hose and getting a face full of water in below zero weather in January. But you might be able to do things like truck checks and equipment inventory and dealing with some of those other kinds of things that are a laborious type of activity for the departments, and we would want to be able to utilize those so that we wouldn't have to have others who maybe have family commitments to do something else in that. So if you could just speak to that one more time for the Commission's benefit, because I think any bill that we have needs to have a provision for that, because we can leverage an awful lot of people who have a lot of experience and a lot more to contribute to their communities if we can do something in the way of an encore activity. And if you know what I'm referring to with Section 6.
Yeah.
Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative. So the Relief Associations have authority right now there's a return to service provision that's in effect right now. And what we're doing in this bill is allowing relief associations to provide a reduced vesting requirement for firefighters who are vested, have gotten paid out, and then want to come back and serve longer. And so the relief association can set a lower vesting requirement for those people. The firefighters still have to be at least age 50 to be paid out. So I think this provision, it was initiated by some of the plans that pay out monthly service pensions. So for those firefighters, every month after age 50 that they don't draw their pension, they're losing out on that monthly benefit. And so there was a lot of desire to allow those folks to get paid out, but they still had a few years left that they wanted to serve. And so this would allow those groups to do that.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Ms. Hennessy Allen, to that point, if someone had a 20-year career, was retiring, even though they had deferred benefits to age 50, and say they had break in service for 3 or 4 years, they were fully vested, I want to make sure that they can come back and are not penalized because they've already been vested in one system. They could have that encore career or a lesser vesting schedule. And in essence, they would be drawing a pension and a half or a pension plus, but they're also giving back to the community that's in need of their skill and service. And there's a cost savings to the community on that, and the institutional knowledge of that individual, plus still meeting a very desperate and dire need of the community.
Ms. Hennessy Allen.
Madam Chair, Representative, under current law, relief associations do have the authority to allow those individuals back, and they just pick up where they left off. So if they were fully vested and resumed active service, they would continue accruing active service credit. They would maintain their fully vested benefit and would just keep adding on to that until the point that they want to get paid out.
And Madam Chair, just one final comment.
Representative O'Driscoll.
My communities are experiencing the exact same thing that Bemidji is, that exact same thing that every city in the state is facing. We're a growing community of almost 20,000 people. And what I fear is going to happen is you're going to have three-quarter staffed departments on paper service, and they're going to need help, and so they're going to call on mutual aid arrangements that they have with neighboring communities, and that's going to tax those departments. And so we don't build up. We actually kind of start tearing down because fewer people are being pressed into service to not only help in their community but to help with other communities. And so this has got to be a cornerstone of in the plan to entice some folks to stick around for a while or to come back in an alternative capacity, because we're missing out on an awful lot of experience and an awful lot of institutional knowledge, like I say. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really want to also address this vesting issue. 20 years seems like such a long time before vesting. I mean, I understand a few years because of the training and the equipment that Representative O'Driscoll mentioned, but it does seem to me on page 9 that you still are allowing fire departments to set 20 years for vesting or use the alternative schedule. Is that accurate?
Ms. Tennessee Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator. So relief associations are required to require firefighters to have at least 5 years of service mm-hmm. to have the reduced vesting schedule. And this bill would allow defined benefit plans to offer fully vested pensions at 10 years. They could require 20 years of service for full vesting. Currently, there are only a handful of relief associations in the state that don't have partial vesting. So there are a few groups that do require 20 years. You get nothing if you leave before 20 mm-hmm. years. But we could report back on the number, but it's a very, very small number that do that.
And, Madam Chair, is it for those groups that you even have this in here? In your working group, they wanted to still maintain the 20 years of vesting? Because it seems to me, why should we even have that?
Mr. Hempstead.
Senator, I think it's still an evolving dynamic. Mm-hmm. I think more and more fire departments, more and more municipalities are realizing the difficulty in retaining and keeping members for a 20-year block of time. So it's been an issue, but it's a growing issue. And so I think the awareness is just becoming more acute right now. And given that now the flexibility to be able to modify to fit what your municipality feels it needs for recruitment and retention is a powerful piece.
Just one more comment, Madam Chair. So, you know, is this the carrot but not the stick, is that we're nudging people to move toward a lower vesting period, but we're not insisting that they do that because it's not a good thing to do that politically, or why don't we just insist?
I think this...
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Chair Murphy, Representative... Senator Pappas. I think that, you know, we're looking at that one of our goals was, again, that local control and keeping mm-hmm. that available. But I think as you're hearing that this is something that very likely can start taking care of itself a bit. Mm-hmm. But we wanted to keep that space for local control on that and ensure that we weren't getting beyond the idea of unanimity as well. But I can speak...
Ms. Hennessy-Allen.
Madam Chairwoman and Senator, there were members of the working group who were concerned in their communities that there would be, I think, a number of people that would leave earlier and that they would lose the firefighters. And so I think there was concern about rushing too fast. And so to try to get to that point, but to do it gradually and allow local control.
Senator Frantz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Auditor Blaha, this is kind of for you. In the private sector, we see vesting at 3 years. You know, if recruitment and retention is a goal, if local control is a goal, do you have an opinion about what the schedule should be?
Auditor Blaha.
Wow, that's a great question, and I do not. At this point with this, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about this group in particular is that as an office, our goal is not to do anything for a fire relief association they can do for themselves. And so we really have great trust and great faith in those people who are running these organizations, the firefighters themselves. So I think really importantly, as an office, we aren't taking a position on that, and we truly want this to come from the firefighters and the fire relief associations themselves. Thank you.
Mr. Hempstead, on that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, each year the Office of the State Auditor conducts a survey and asks us, the departments and the state, what kinds of issues we'd like to have discussed in that next session. And then our very first meeting, then we begin to prioritize those. That has come up in the past, and I'm highly suspect that it will come up again.
Senator France.
Thank you again, Madam Chair, and you know, thanks for the answer as far as it went. I guess my question for the world would be, if we're interested in competing in the private sector or with people who have private sector options, and if 3 years is an option in the private sector, if we want to allow local control, one of the things we don't currently do is allow local control down to 3 years. I'm just throwing it out there for the commission. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The answer, Senator Pappas. Oh, not on this point.
Yes, I'm changing the subject from investment with my question. So
but you're still on the subject.
Yes,
on the yes. Go ahead,
okay.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you. I wanted to bring up the issue of augmentation. As you know, in the pension reform bill, we eliminated augmentation for MSRS, PERA, and TRA, and I'm wondering if the working group talked about that issue at all.
Ms. Hennessy-Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator. So deferred interest or augmentation is optional for relief associations. Fewer than half provide it. And one of the differences between relief associations and the statewide retirement system is their funding. Only 49 relief associations in the state have a deficit right now, so it's a very different financial picture than the statewide retirement systems. Also, for the deferred interest that relief associations can provide, there's a couple of options on how they can do it, but two of the options are to set up a separate investment account or a separate investment vehicles for the deferred members, mm-hmm. and their money is transferred into that separate account, and the deferred member bears the full investment risk. So the relief association fund doesn't, there is no unfunded liability for that.
Okay. Any further questions? Well, in response to the report that we've just heard is House File 2373, Ms. Lincheski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I prepared a memo to the commission, and the memo is a section-by-section summary of the bill. But I really wanted to just, you know, Rose, Ms. Hennessy-Allen, and Ms. Blaha, you know, did a great job of going through the bill. But I wanted to raise three issues. The one has to do with the addition of the language relating to a legal compliance audit. For some time, I've had some concern that there are a number of legal compliance items that I was not seeing as being part of what the state auditor is looking at in the audits of the relief associations. I provided two examples. One is in 356, and it relates to certain requirements that are derived from the Internal Revenue Code but are reflected in our statutes, and they relate to required minimum distributions, vesting on plan termination, and most importantly, the right to elect a direct rollover. That's one example. The other is in our fiduciary duty statutes in 356A, and there is a requirement that the relief associations diversify their plan assets. And to that point, I included something that we received in our office, and we receive a lot of these. This is the last page of my memo. This is the kind of thing that we see on a pretty regular basis. And my concern has been that this does not indicate diversification, and so I think is a problem under our statutes. So I'm just raising this as an issue that it would be great if the legal compliance audits that are being done here would include some of these other statutes.
Auditor Blaha.
Thank you. This is thank you, Chair Murphy and Ms. Lincheski. I think this is a great opportunity for someone who's been in the job for just over 2 months to talk about something highly technical. But I believe that we have, and I think we do need some further discussion on that. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the office has checked with the IRS to see if that would make sense for our legal audits, and it does not seem to be the case. We want to be really careful that we're not duplicating effort from another agency. As much as I do enjoy expanding our work into new areas, I want to make sure we are not using time and resources in a way that already been used in some in another format. So I believe our conversations with the IRS are that this should not be part of our legal compliance audit. And then I think we also have an opportunity on that form that you're seeing in there. There seems to be some confusion about that form. So I think that we may want to kind of work with you on that form and see if there might be a way to get the information we have. I think this information may not be as illustrative of what's truly happening because of an old form. I think that came in before you and I. So I think many of us. So I think there's some opportunities to fix that to see if that truly is an issue for us.
Ms. Lincheski.
So my second point has to do with the comment that I made over on page 4, and that again relates to vesting, and we've had a thorough discussion on the topic. To Senator Frentz's point, I did mention what is permitted in the private sector. So if we were to try to compete, I guess, or at least sort of replicate what's going on there and what is permitted, what's going on is the flip side of what we see here, which is to say, the federal government is concerned that people aren't getting their pension, so they put limits on how much of a vesting requirement you can have. We view this in the other direction, which is to say we want a longer vesting requirement. And so my only thought there is that maybe we need to add even a little bit more flexibility so that if there is an interest in paying benefits out after a certain vesting period, that would be shorter than is permitted. Especially in, I'll note, the volunteer firefighter relief associations that don't pay anything at all to their firefighters, it might be worth considering opening this up just a little bit more. I also wanted to note that there is some incentive, I believe, on the part of sort of the status quo or whatever at the relief associations, because vesting means that there's forfeitures. So if someone doesn't vest fully or at all, that accrued benefit or that account is forfeited, and it does then get absorbed. So it increases surplus in the defined benefit situation. It is available for allocation to accounts in the defined contribution situation. So I wanted to mention that as well as my kind of second comment here.
Senator Pappas.
Just clarify for me with volunteer firefighter relief associations, can they still not, even if they're vested at an earlier point and they leave service, they still can't collect until a certain age, like 55 or 60 or something like that?
Yeah. Madam
Ms.
Chair.
Lincheski.
Senator Pappas, they have to wait until they're age 50.
Okay.
So there could be a period of time where they're not in the plan, but we'll get their benefit eventually. So my third point is on page 5, and again it relates to augmentation, which was already brought up. I just merely wanted to note that when we did the sweep last year, took out augmentation for everybody, I was not aware that we had this interest thing going on in the Relief Association. So there is perhaps some reason to think about that again and whether augmentation should continue in this situation when it is not permitted in the public pension plans generally. That's comments.
Any comment from the group? Okay. Any further questions? Is there anyone else that wants to comment about the report or about House File 2373? If not, I will hold 2373 over for possible inclusion. Number five on the agenda, moving right along, is the third report of the evening, the Work Group on Relief Association Conversions and Dissolutions Report. Mr. Mark Rosenblum of Golden Valley Fire Department, President, and Tim Wiebe, Fire Chief of Chaska Fire Department. Welcome to the Commission, and please present your report. Ms. Lencheski.
Thank you. We had a quick meeting yesterday, and I had hoped that we would go through the report, and then we would have some comments from the fire chief and the chair of the Firefighter Association. So I will jump right into the report. It's a rather long report, so I'll try to be as succinct on this as possible. Just by way of some background, the reason why surplus has become a bit of an issue relates to what was going on in Maplewood last year. And there is a description of the Maplewood situation on page 17 of the report, not of the PowerPoint, but in the report. And the situation there was that Maplewood was very overfunded, had $1.5 million, I believe, in excess assets. Those are assets in excess of benefit liabilities. And the city of Maplewood determined that they would no longer need the services of the volunteers. So the volunteers were terminated. Their services were ended. And in response, the Fire Relief Association determined that they would not close down their relief association. So people were no longer accruing any more active service, but there was no way really to access the surplus and no way to do anything as far as the firefighter benefits there. So the situation then it moved on to the Relief Association determining that the way to get at the surplus was to convert to a defined contribution plan. So the theory was that all of the assets could then be allocated to all of the accounts of the firefighters, and that way they would then use up the assets. They could then, you know, dissolve the Relief Association and everybody would get their much larger benefit, their account. When that was underway, the city filed suit to stop that from happening. The decision was made to go to the legislature and help with a settlement agreement that they had arrived at. So it needed some special legislation. That legislation then required the Relief Association to sort of unconvert, to go back to a defined benefit plan. All the firefighters became 100% vested. The benefit level for these firefighters increased from where it was, which I can't recall, but it went up to $11,000. And then the Fire Relief Association would be dissolved, and any surplus would be transferred to the city. And I understand after payment of attorney's fees, there was some surplus, and that reverted to the city. The Board of Trustees and the city needed to agree to that, and I believe that's all been wrapped up. But that did cause some interest in what's happening with the surplus and this issue of conversion and then what happens to the surplus at the end of dissolution of the Relief Association. So the work group was formed. We met six times over the course of the interim. We were required, and I'm now moving into the PowerPoint on slide three, we were required to determine what the current state of the law was in Minnesota for doing these conversions, and then under the law, who receives the surplus when a relief association ends. We were also to look at the prevalence of overfunding and what actions are being taken out in the relief associations and the cities to access that surplus. And then the two questions at the end there were really kind of a summary of what we were looking at, which was how to do these conversions, what the state law should say about that, and whether we needed to change the state law to require that instead of the surplus going to the municipality, it would instead go to perhaps the firefighters or maybe some combination of the municipality and the firefighters. The work group members are listed on pages 4 and 5. Like the other work group, they consisted of municipal officials. We had 3 of those. We had Ann Finn from the League of Minnesota Cities, 4 fire chiefs, 2 of whom have since retired, a total of 5 volunteer firefighters. That included 2 people, Mark Rosenblum, who's here, and Bruce Hempstead, who you saw earlier. And then in addition, we had a number of other people who brought some expertise, and these were 3 firefighters. We had Rose Hennessy Allen from the State Auditor's Office, and then someone from an independent nonprofit firefighting corporation. The work group kind of began with a review of the data on overfunding. There is an Exhibit A to the report that provides that data, and in summary, there are a lot of firefighter or fire relief associations that are overfunded. We have 8 relief associations with a funding level of 300% or more, 27 from 200 to 299% funded, and 412 that are 100 to 199% funded. So, of course, that does depend on how investments are doing in these funds, but as of 2017, that's what the data showed. In order to find out what relief associations were doing, the work group formed a subgroup to prepare a survey that would go out to all of the fire chiefs in the state to ask many questions about the status of their fire relief association, their fire department, and then ask some questions about whether they're considering conversions or really any changes to personnel. We sent then the survey to 775 fire chiefs, received responses from 293 fire chiefs, which was 38% and a very good cross-section of the fire chiefs across the state. An Exhibit B to the report is a map showing where the fire relief or where the fire chiefs are located, and Exhibit C is the actual survey. So the questions and the responses are all laid out there. In the interest of time, I won't go over the next couple slides, which go into the results of the survey. But I think one pretty significant point is that very few of them were considering a conversion. So we don't know exactly what that means, whether that means the idea hasn't hit them, that that's one way to access surplus, or whether the fact that there's no procedure to doing a conversion is a factor, but that's not really on people's minds. The data is interesting, I think, if anybody is interested in. For instance, I think one of the other data points is that we also asked about who is paying their firefighters. And on slide 10, we discovered that 19% of this group, or 52 fire departments, pay their firefighters no compensation at all. So these are truly the volunteers in the system. 81% do pay their firefighters, and they pay them generally on either an hourly basis or a per-call basis. So moving on to slide 13, we started the process of what would a conversion look like and how would that be done. So the process now would be something that we would put into legislation because right now under state law there is no process. So this would be new law. So the start would be with the Board of Trustees. They would approve the conversion. And one other important part about conversion, federal law does apply to these plans if they believe that they are a qualified retirement plan. So under federal law, when you convert a DB to a DC, it is effectively a termination of the defined benefit plan and the establishment of a new defined contribution plan to which there is a transfer of the benefit into accounts in the defined contribution plan. So that would need to be sort of incorporated into this process. So initially, they would approve the conversion, determine an effective date for that, and then they would also have to adopt a new defined contribution plan. Because it is a termination of the old defined benefit plan, they would need to fully vest all the firefighters. And this would be both the actives and the inactives. So anybody with an accrued benefit in that defined benefit plan would have to become fully vested. Moving on to slide 14. So we're talking about relief associations with surplus. And the discussion went to how do we deal with the surplus so that people perhaps can get that surplus into their benefits. So the consensus of the group was that the Board of Trustees would be permitted to increase the surplus or increase the benefit level to eat up the surplus. So the new benefit level would not have to be subject to the current $10,000 limit, but could go up as far as needed to, again, zero out the assets. So by way of an example, say the benefit level is $2,000 a year, so a person would have, say, $2,000 benefit level times 10 years of service, they'd have a $20,000 lump sum benefit. In this scenario, if there's sufficient assets, the board could determine that they would go to, say, $3,000 as the benefit level, in which case that person would have a $30,000 accrued benefit, which could then be transferred into an account in a defined contribution plan. So at that point, there will likely not be much by way of surplus because the board would most likely increase the benefit level to the point that there were no additional assets. If that wasn't the intent and there was a desire to revert some of that to the municipality, the group talked through what the alternatives are for disposing of the surplus. So this would be where the surplus stays in the plan. Initially, that would be one of the options. It could be then distributed to the firefighters, again, to increase their benefit on a per-head basis or based on years of service. Or the other option is on page 16, where the Relief Association could share the surplus with the municipality. Share it just with no strings attached, or share it by directing that the municipality use it for, say, a contribution to a defined, let's see. So some of the options would be to buy firefighting equipment, that sort of thing, firefighting purposes. Also, it could possibly be used to provide health insurance for firefighters. So moving on to slide 17, if the plan does not have a surplus but would like to convert, the consensus was that that would probably not be permitted unless the municipality agreed to cover the shortfall or the Board of Trustees amended their bylaws to reduce the benefit level to a level that would allow the plan to convert. Those options are on slide 17. So generally speaking, unless there's a reduction in the benefit or the municipality wishes to contribute something in order to make this happen, a conversion would not be allowed. So the second step would be determining the value of the benefits. There's two ways permitted under the statute. We would use those. This is generally the methods used for determining the value of a benefit. Those would be brought into this process as well. It could be done by an actuary that's engaged or using a formula that is in the statute. Step three would be providing notice to the firefighters. So all of this process up till now has been going on at the Board of Trustees level. The firefighters need some notice, it was agreed. So there will be a notice. It will provide what's going on, sort of describing the conversion. A summary of the newly adopted defined contribution plan. Also provides specific information specific to the firefighter, which would give him an estimate of him or her, an estimate of the value of the benefit, and then talk about any surplus and how that would be allocated. In addition, there would be notice to the municipality and the state auditor. Slide 21 is implementation. So once we've gone through the Board of Trustees and the notice, then the implementation would include the adoption and rollout of the new defined contribution plan and establishing accounts in the trust. The surplus and the benefits then could be transferred into those accounts. There is an example on page 15 of the report that kind of goes through the process with a firefighter, an example of a firefighter and how the firefighter would benefit from the conversion and how really he would be treated under that situation. So that is conversion. The next big topic is disposition of the surplus upon plan termination or dissolution of the relief association. Moving on to slide 23, we do have some statutes on that. So 424B.20 does address the situation of dissolution. It doesn't cover every situation. So, for instance, on slide 23, I've listed some of the situations that are not covered by the statute. The fourth bullet is the Maplewood situation. So there wasn't really a process there that they could follow that would address the issues that had come up in that situation. And again, going back to what happened there, that was the termination of the service of all non-career firefighters. And then the Relief Association not wanting to terminate or dissolve the Relief Association. The problem with that, and that's addressed on slide 24, is that as long as the Relief Association continues to exist, it will continue to get state aid. So even though there's no actives and no service being accrued, the fire state aid will continue to go into that Relief Association and just grow the surplus. So obviously that's a somewhat frustrating place for the municipality to be. So we then came up with some recommendations for amending the statutes. First would be to broaden the application. So anytime there's a desire to dissolve the Relief Association, this statute would apply. We would also require that the Relief Association be dissolved. So if the municipality terminates the service of all of its non-career firefighters and transitions to using only career firefighters, the Relief Association would be required to dissolve. And that would then activate these other provisions that I'll be talking about in a minute here that will deal with the surplus. So current law, we can go back to that on slide 25. That is the part that still works in this situation. In 424B.20, the process is to calculate the assets, liquidate enough of the assets to pay legal obligations, then prepare a schedule of the firefighters' benefits, and then transfer any remaining assets to the municipality. So this is where things get interesting for the work group. This is what they had determined would be the place where changes should be made. And then there's some notice requirements as well. So once this all happens, then the statute would require notification. So some of this remains, some of this is revised, and I'll mention here the amendments that the group suggested. So slide 26, as I mentioned, this is a termination of a plan, so it would require immediate full vesting, just as in the case of the conversion. The work group determined that just in the case of conversion, where we were allowing for a benefit increase to eat up the surplus, we would allow it in this case as well. And they determined that a limit should be put on that. So that would be up to 125% of the current statutory maximum. That is $10,000, so that would mean $12,500 is as high as it could go. There are not many relief associations that are anywhere near this level, so it would be really the larger kind of suburban relief associations for the most part that would even bump up against this this maximum. We would retain the current law on calculation of benefits. And then moving to slide 27, we would change the law to allow immediate distribution. So this is a case where there will not be a relief association up and running. The municipality, the officials there, didn't see the need to have those accounts or those accrued benefits transfer over to the municipality. So instead of that, we would amend the statute to allow for the distribution of benefits right away. In addition, we would work with the Department of Revenue to see if they could go ahead and pay supplemental benefits at any age. So the distributions would be made to people who had not yet attained age 50. Under the statute currently, these firefighters are entitled, or survivors are entitled, to a supplemental benefit only if they have reached age 50. So we would work with the Department of Revenue and make some changes to that law so they would also get this. And again, this was discussed, in the state auditor's presentation. These are the benefits that are intended to cover liability for state tax on distributions. We would also provide for pre-termination notice, and this would be actually notice in advance of the termination. So 30 days prior to the wind down, the Commissioner of Revenue, the state auditor, and the Secretary of State would receive notice. Then the part that got the most, I think, discussion, starting on slide 28. Under current law, when the Relief Association dissolves and benefits are all taken care of, any remaining surplus or any remaining assets in the trust fund cancel to the general fund of the municipality. The thought, really the consensus of the group, and alternatives were talked through. So as I mentioned, retain current law was one. Obviously, the other was to amend the law to allow it simply to go to the firefighters. And the third was some split among the municipality and the firefighters. Page 29 talks about really the compromise position. And this was to allow for a transfer to the municipality if the municipality had made required contributions over the preceding 10 years. So the amount that would be transferred would be equal to those contributions without any interest or earnings on that amount. The municipality under the law would be required to use use that money for firefighter-related payments, so, for instance, contributions to Parapolice and Fire Plan, and then, as I mentioned earlier, similar situations, so fire equipment, fire department buildings, that sort of thing. And then finally, if after all of this, so this is after the after the full vesting, benefit level increase, payment of required contributions, if there was anything left, then the Relief Association and the municipality have to agree on how to split that remaining surplus. They have 6 months to do that, and if an agreement cannot be reached in the six-month period, then the consensus of the group at the time was that the surplus would be paid to the firefighters. The Relief Association would determine how that surplus would be split among the firefighters. It could be based on years of service or on a per capita basis. After the report went out, the league had lodged an objection to this last bit, and they offered a compromise. They felt that this probably went too far in the firefighter direction. And the league asked that maybe a compromise could be offered, and I've laid that out. That would just be that the surplus would be evenly split between the municipality and the firefighters. The final comment here, or the final item, is on slide 31. There is a provision that was enacted in the 2018 bill that applies to Plymouth and three other relief associations, and it requires that any surplus upon dissolution of those relief associations is to be paid to the state. The relief association felt that that should be repealed so that all relief associations can be treated the same way, and the procedure that we just talked about would apply to those relief associations as well. And that is the report.
Ms. Lincheski, in the report where you talked about the survey and over 50% of the municipalities paid something to firefighters. Where did that money come from that pays the firefighters?
Madam Chair, that comes from the municipality. So they pay their firefighters. They're considered volunteer or non-career, and the municipality pays them the per hour or the per call. And we could ask the gentleman here at the table to confirm that if you'd like.
All right. Thank you. Do you want to respond to the report, Mr. Rosenblum and Mr. Wiebe?
Sure. Madam Chair, Commission, thank you for allowing me to be here. Again, we...
Please identify yourself.
Tim Wiebe, Chaska Fire Chief.
Thank you.
Representing the State Fire Chiefs Association. We, as a group, spent a number of meetings going through a process, and I think our mission really was to create a process or a roadmap if fire departments encountered these situations, which we didn't really have in the past. We believe that we came up with some good solutions for people to look at to move forward to address these concerns if they do arise. And we believe that this would be a positive for the majority of the firefighters across the state of Minnesota with what we laid out in front of this commission tonight, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Rosenblum?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the commission. Mark Rosenblum, Golden Valley firefighter and president of the State Fire Department Association. Similar to what Chief Wiebe said, I think that this group in the meetings that we held came up with a good framework, a good basis for providing information or an outline for people who are relief associations and fire departments and municipalities who want to work through a dissolution or a conversion type process. As Ms. Lincheski said in her report, we found that there aren't a lot of people that are looking at this option, but at least if there are some who do want to consider something like this. And I think that as funding ratios increase, there may be more that want to consider something like this, although they're not thinking about it now. I think this is a good position or at least framework or structure for people to use, and it definitely gives them the things that they need to consider in the process if they're thinking about going that direction. I will say that one of the comments that came up in my mind is that I know we as part of the discussion we talked about the municipalities receiving some of the funds back to them. I just want to make it clear that with the monies and the 2% money is the whole other work group that we've talked about earlier. The 2% money is state driven money is collected by the state. By the state from the insurance premiums, as we've outlined, as many of you know. The municipality, I think, in the framework here definitely should get paid back for any contributions that they've made to relief associations to support their increases or to support their shortcomings. But as far as them receiving the funds to fund other programs or other things going back to the municipality, they really didn't have a say in that prior to a dissolution or a conversion. So that's just something that I wanted to throw out there and why I think it kind of came back in the discussions afterwards about that. But I think the key here is agreement, and that's the problem that we ran into with the Maplewood scenario, is that there was not a lot of agreement. It became hostile, and I think as many of us talk about in the just realms that we operate in, it really became a win for the attorneys that were involved. And that's what we want to avoid going forward. Thank you.
Does anyone else want to respond to the report that you heard tonight? If not, on behalf of the commission, I will receive this and we'll think about your suggestions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions about anything on the agenda tonight? Is there anyone that wants to address the commission for any purpose? Mr. Zickman. Welcome to the commission. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the commission, Niall Zuckman, before tonight, representing myself, but I would reflect back on your opening night where I introduced myself as my 28th session, primarily focused on passion above volunteer fire issues. And I'll just share with you a suggestion I had made to the chair. And if you have the ability to go to Exhibit A in this report that lists the funding ratios. So as I've been working on volunteer pensions for the 28 years and been responsible for a number of the changes working
Excuse
with
Mr. Zuckman, you held something up.
So it's Exhibit A. It has all the funding ratios.
Okay. It's in the report. It's in the report, yes.
In the report. The second report, the report you just talked about.
And I see it. Okay.
And this is in the form of a suggestion. So, Senator Pappas, you asked if there was a link between the first report and the last report, and I would suggest there is, and the state aid, by allowing the cities to negotiate and start dividing that state aid, you will help reduce the surplus problem. That was one of the primary drivers in the metropolitan departments as they converted, and you still had to send the money to the relief, but they had fewer volunteers. That's where, in part, the surplus built. Back in 2013, the veteran legislators remembered there was an additional pension aid fix. Mr. Rice was involved in that. I was involved with that. It put an additional $9 million into PRAP&F, and it put $5 million into the volunteer reliefs. That had a sunset. Now Supreme Court Justice Thiessen on this commission 3 years ago sunsetted that relief. Sunsetted the sunset of the relief. Okay. So that money is still pouring in. And then the investment returns. So in my 28 years, I've never seen the volunteer reliefs so overfunded. It's a function of those factors. In my new capacity, I'm now a city administrator in a local municipal suburban department that I used to be the fire chief for. And I see what I would describe as an overwhelmed electorate in my council member that I work for and in the listserv that I'm on. And I would suggest these surpluses are also a function of elected policymakers at the local level being overwhelmed the way it is, and then the relief stuff comes to them, and they're also well overwhelmed. And so they're reluctant to raise these benefits. And so Representative, former Chair Driscoll, commented about you need to do everything you can to help the volunteers. You have massive surpluses to raise benefits. It's not happening. We have Mr. Anderson from PRA that runs the state plan. There's another 140 plans in the state plan. The same phenomena is occurring there, where you have more surpluses than ever in history. They don't have the ability to do, there's a workaround at the local level. The relief can go raise the benefit without the council permission. There's sometimes a political consequence, so you don't see them doing that. The state plan don't have to do that. I suggested to PRA in that working group, and I'm suggesting here, maybe you consider doing another study of it's the only public pension plan I know in the state where the benefit level is set at the municipal level. And perhaps you want to work on a study group looking at another alternative. The suggestion would be some kind of a trigger. Once you're over 120% funded, maybe there's an automatic trigger. I don't know what the public pension policy is of building surpluses of 200%, 300%, 400%. And so it's a suggestion that as part of your bill, you do another study. The LCPR staff could do it. You've got the model for the studies. And is there a way to address these surpluses? Or you're going to start. I used to do a bunch of consulting. I've had reliefs contact me. Can you come help us work with our city to raise the benefits? I said, you know, I'd rather work at this level and deal with it statewide than me going out, you know, one at a time. I don't need the time. I don't need the energy. I don't need the money. I'd rather, you know, just work on good public policy. So a suggestion, Madam Chair, for you to do as you please.
Thank you very much. We'll take that under consideration, too. Mr. Rice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Rice. And since the last two testifiers, one implied my name and another mentioned it, I thought I should comment. Mr. Zickman is right. In 2014, I was hired by him when he was the head of the Chiefs Association and worked with you, Madam Chair, to provide substantial additional assistance to not only the PRA Police and Fire Fund at the time that was experiencing funding issues, $9 million, but another $5 million for volunteer firefighters. And as I look at these numbers today, I'd have to say I'm quite shocked. The idea of that money was to help get pensions to firefighters, not build up accounts that municipalities around the state potentially could poach and put in their general fund, like the city of Maplewood did. And yes, Chief Rosenbaum, I represented them. And believe me, it wasn't the lawyers who won. It was Maplewood who fired volunteer firefighters three times. Not once, not twice, but three times. And who are these volunteer firefighters? They made $13, $14 an hour. No vacation, no health care, no sick leave, no nothing. People that are working fast food restaurants make more than volunteer firefighters generally in the metropolitan area. But yet the city of Maplewood thought they saw a big pot of money and they said, let's get our hands on it. That's my view on it. And yes, when we tried to protect those assets and use them for the purpose I thought this legislature intended, to pay volunteer firefighters a pension. And by the way, if you take all this, Maplewood had $10,000. So I did some calculation. If you took a firefighter who had worked 20 years, got a full pension, on average, these individuals, mostly men, worked about 900 to 1,000 hours a year. They'd make $13,000. They would work 12-hour shifts overnight during the week from 6 to 6, or they'd work weekend shifts of 24 on a Friday to a Saturday. They would work Christmas, Thanksgiving, holidays. They would get about $13 per hour of service, getting the biggest pension you could get in this state at $10,000. They would get $13.50 for the hourly work that they did. They would get, that was their compensation. That was their remuneration for going out and doing the work, the Lord's work, protecting all of us. And that was excessive. And to hear the rhetoric from the city of Maplewood, you thought these guys were ripping off the public, Chief Rosenbaum. So I have no apologies. They got sued then. I defended that lawsuit, but glad that I did. The city of Maplewood, at the end of the day, still got $1 million out of it. When you look at Exhibit A and see how much money has been built up in these accounts, there is a problem with these relief associations. And frankly, everything you've heard tonight, none of it's going to address these surpluses. You actually, if you want a reform agenda, you should go to three-year vesting for these volunteer firefighters. And you should, you might start it, and you should make sure these people, for all the work they do, that they actually get paid for the service they do as soon as they can do it. One of the issues that started the Maplewood thing is twice this legislature passed raising the cap from $10,000 to $15,000. It was only when Maplewood woke up to that reality, even though it had been passed the legislature twice and vetoed by Governor Dayton twice, they realized, oh, this might be a problem. They'll take our money. No, it's not your money, Maplewood. It was the firefighters' money. That's what triggered this. In all of the bills I've seen tonight, no one's proposing to raise that cap for the funds that have it, or to distribute the money more fairly to the workers who do it, or to have these cities say, no, what, you worked here for 3 years, by that time you know what a firefighter is, let's vest you at 100%, or let's at least do half, and say that you're going to get this money out of it. And, you know, members, this is a serious issue. That Minnesota, we always hear it, we're too high, and we're top 10 in tax, or we're paying too much. Firefighters, we rank 44th, or is it 45th, Mr. Zickman, in per capita spending on firefighters in Minnesota. You know why that is, members? Because you've got like 20,000 volunteer firefighters. Some are getting 13 or 14, 20% get nothing except their pension. And so you got the best deal going, so let's figure out a way to maybe let cities get this money. I think that's craziness. Honestly, it would be the wrong thing to do. You should be getting the money to these volunteers that are doing the work, that are keeping your taxes down, that are protecting the public. You know, that's what I tried to do with Maplewood. Chief accused me of getting too much money. I don't think I did. I was very proud of that. There were 20-some individuals who put in over 300 years of work for Maplewood and got fired, not once, not twice, but three times. They didn't even get a letter from them. They got a text message an hour before they were supposed to show up. Why? Because the city didn't like them converting and trying to keep the money that you gave to them. And Maplewood had this idea that the city should get any money back. The only reason a city contributes to a relief association now is because they committed to pay a pension benefit. They agreed to pay it. The way the statute works now is that the city and the members can agree that we'll set the pension at $6,000. If the market falls and we're short, the statute says the city will have to make up the shortfall. If the members say, no, we'll set it at 10, the city only agrees to 6. If the market falls, the city isn't obligated to anything more than they agree to by an action of the city council. You've been giving me the signal, Madam Chair. We're probably at 7 o'clock. But of all the work groups you've seen tonight, none of it's going to, it might help all the cities tonight, and it might, and I think that, Susan and her staff have put some things in that are certainly worth considering, but look at Exhibit A and study it and see how much overfunded these plans are. That was never the intent. When you carried the pension bill in 13 and helped us get this aid, and Representative Carlson and Speaker Thiessen did, I guess I'm shocked that all the money is still sitting in the accounts, not being used to the benefit of the people who provided the service. I'm sure you didn't vote for that bill to put the money in because of you wanted to put stuff more money into the pockets of cities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for renewing our intent. Is there any other further business to come before this commission tonight? We have a lot to think about, and those surpluses could be being used. So let's see what we can think about together. This meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.
Which one is that?